playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. The world of theatre was in deepest mourning this week when news broke that Tom Murphy, one of the giants of Irish literature, had died. He was 83.
Writing, to me, is happiness. I have had the occasional, not very frequent, moment through a long life in the business. Wonderful moments, and I'm looking for more sort of moments, which paradoxically would be, if I look at a clock and it's 7:10 in the morning, and I look at the clock next and it's 2:10 in the afternoon, that I've stepped out of time. And that's as close to happiness as one can get, I think, if one can step out of time. I would like to step out of time a few times more before the full stop happens.
Well, the full stop happened on Tuesday, but alongside the sadness, there was also a sense of gratitude for his extraordinary talent and the body of work he created in a writing career that spanned almost 60 years. Plays like On the Outside, Famine, A Whistle in the Dark, The Sanctuary Lamp, The Gili Concert, Conversations on a Homecoming and Ballygan Goyra. His close friend, President Michael D. Higgins, led the tributes, describing his contribution to Irish theatre as immeasurable and outstanding. Druid's artistic director Gary Hines was a long-time collaborator with Tom Murphy, and the trilogy Druid Murphy toured internationally in 2014. From New York, she spoke to Maggie Doyle on Morning Ireland.
Tom, for me, both in his work and as a person, he was the essence of life. He was a life force in every possible respect, in the rage with which he wrote about things, in the love with which he wrote about things, and just the notion of him not being here is simply far too difficult to accept yet. I'm also thinking, obviously, of the massive loss to Jane and to Mary and to his children and to all those people who were close to him, whom he mattered so much to.
President Higgins has said that the importance of Tom's contribution to Irish theatre is immeasurable and outstanding.
I would entirely agree with them. I mean, I came to his work in the late 70s, early 80s, and we began our professional relationship and friendship then, and he has been at the centre of my life and of Druid's life, and of anybody, I think, who has worked with him. He has been absolutely at the centre of our lives all that time. And I think I feel bereft, and I know that my colleagues feel the same. There are Druids performing in Washington, D.C., and I know they're going to step forward and ask for a final round of applause for him tonight from the stage. The world has gone dark, funnily enough, in the rehearsal room here today, about 4 o'clock this afternoon, New York time. A huge storm passed over New York. It was quite frightening. We all sort of stopped. The world went very dark. And just very shortly later, I received the news. So that's what it feels like. It feels like nature is even in sympathy and in protest against his passing.
Druid co-founder Gary Hines. Well, Tom Murphy's biographer, Fintan O'Toole, discussed his legacy with Rachel English.
It's interesting, isn't it, that he started writing plays at a time when many people were leaving Ireland, and his first full-length play, A Whistle in the Dark, it was first performed in London.
Yes, that wasn't by choice. He submitted the play to the Abbey Theatre, which was then run by the notoriously conservative Ernest Blythe, and he didn't just get a rejection letter, you know, the usual standard one about sorry we can't put on your play. He got a kind of really abusive letter from Blythe saying there are no such people in Ireland as are in your play, which of course was doubly ironic. You know, it was partly just not accepting the very dark view of Ireland that that Murphy was giving, but also literally this was a society torn apart by emigration. Tom himself came from a family of 10, and by the time he had started writing, it was just himself and his mother left. His father worked in England and all his siblings worked in England. So he knew emigration in his bones, and it was something But it wasn't just a sociological fact. It sort of shaped the way he thought about the world. Everything in his plays is kind of broken. Everybody feels that they're not quite a full person. Things don't fully cohere. And that's rooted in the huge psychological trauma of mass immigration and of the society where people just couldn't stay.
I was reading a quote this morning from him from an interview a few years back, and he said, "There's a rage in me which I think is a natural thing. Rage not against the unfairness of life. Life is of course unfair, but against the inequalities, the arrogance of power."
Yeah, you know, he wouldn't have regarded himself, you know, as a maker of political statements in his plays. His plays are kind of as much metaphysical and psychological as they are political. But, you know, it's no accident that the first one-act play that he wrote is called On the Outside. He's a very acute critic of the way in which church and state operated in Ireland, the repressive nature of that particular combination as he experienced it in the 1950s and 1960s. And he really then, I think he went on to deal with, and this is maybe why he was so incredibly important to Irish people, to deal with the sort of all of the complexities, the psychological complexities of a society that was trying to modernize and unsure of what modernization meant. Did it just mean becoming American? Was there something particular about Ireland that we also could preserve? And he was a great truth teller. You know, he was a very uncomfortable figure. The view of the Irish male psychology that he gave was not a pretty one. But the extraordinary thing about him is that he managed to turn that sort of very marginal kind of existence into something sweeping and epic and ultimately something hopeful. He was full of yearning. His plays are tragic, but they're always trying to reach beyond the tragic towards some kind of transformation and some kind of hope. And in that, of course, it's really important to say he was very, very funny. His plays are very dark, but they are absolutely screamingly funny and witty and brilliant.
In the many tributes to Tom Murphy, there were frequent references to his passion for music. The actor Sean McGinley has starred in many of Tom Murphy's plays, and he spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
My abiding memory of Tom, the man, is singing.
Yes.
He always sang. He'd sing at the drop of a hat. He sings in his plays. He would sing at any sort of occasion. So I hope he's singing now.
Well, one of Tom Murphy's favourite songs was Conja Conja Tua Voye, sung by Beniamino Gigli. Here it is now, in his memory.
Congia, congia, tue moglie, o mio cor, che fedele, posti a donna, crudele. Congia, congia, tue moglie, o mio cor, che fedele, posti a donna, non t'accorgi meschin che sei ferito, lascia d'amar chi t'ha tradito, lascia d'amar chi t'ha tradito.
Celebrating the life and work of playwright Tom Murphy, who died on Tuesday. Ryan Tuberty was out and about this week. He broadcast live from Arnott's in Mary Street, Dublin, to celebrate the 175th birthday of the iconic store. And there were lots of prizes to be won. All you had to do was answer the question.
A 17-year-old schoolgirl model, an icon of the swinging 60s. What was her name? She was known as like something you might see in a branch of a tree, but off a branch of a tree, you'd a bit of a stick called a...
Olive branch.
It's not olive branch. It rhymes with Criggy or Fliggy. Come on, help me out here.
I'm lost.
Rhymes with Piggy.
Miss Piggy, is it?
Yeah, well, look, she's a model. Like, she's hardly Miss Piggy. Do me a favour.
Right.
Say Twiggy to me.
Twiggy.
How did you get that?
Very generous with the hints there. Ryan also met Gerard Nolan. Gerard is about to celebrate his 94th birthday and began working in Arnott's haberdashery department in 1942.
So when I did come in first, it was really so big. And I remember so well all the different departments.
Yes.
And one of the things that struck me was everybody was so neat.
Yeah.
The men had their hair combed. Brilcream was the order of the day. And the ladies were so elegant.
Yeah.
And of course, I have to say, they still are.
Yeah, yeah. You mention ladies a lot, Gerard. You obviously have an eye for the quality things in life. Men well-groomed, ladies well-turned out, if you like. Has the world changed, or is everyone doing the right thing?
Well, one of the things we had to watch out for when we were selling our goods, that everything would be so neat and good and so on.
Yes.
Now I look in the windows and I see, I notice the guaranteed to fade. And then I see ladies going around, very nice ladies, young ladies too, with holes in their knees. I find it a bit hard for the steps.
Times are hard for people, you know. Times are hard. Can I ask you a last question, Gerard?
Yeah.
What would you like to be when you grow up?
Well, I have great aspirations.
Tell me.
Yeah. I really want to do one of the parachute jumps.
Oh, come on. Go on.
So,
do you?
The family, of course, nearly got a heart attack when I mentioned this. And then I just want to be able to do the things I love to do, that I get out and walk, meet people, and enjoy life as best as I can.
Why do you want to do a parachute jump?
Because I have good knees.
So while you have them.
So, well, exactly, the very thing. I also just want to live a reasonably good life with my family. That's really what I want to do. And I'm doing very well so far, thank God. People are congratulating me about my age and so on, but it's not me at all, of course, it's the man above.
Yeah.
And he's looking after me and looking after everyone, really.
Gerard Nolan, who is, as he told Ryan, age 93 and 7/8. Another of Ryan's guests was Chupi Sweetman, the Irish designer behind the jewellery brand Chupi. Arnott's is a huge part of her story. She got her start there, and she now exhibits her range at London Fashion Week.
Let's get the name thing out of the way immediately. Your real name is Chupi. It is not a stage name. It's something you were given the day you were born. Tell us why.
I blame my parents.
Blame parents, always. What do they do and why?
They worked over in Central America speaking Spanish the whole time. So they came back to Ireland still very much in love with speaking Spanish. And it means baby. So it's basically like being called baby.
That's cute.
Oh, I was desperate when I was 15. I hated them passionately.
Yeah, how old were you when you wrote your first cookbook?
I was 17 when I wrote your first cookbook.
Very young to be getting on to that business, but it did very well for you. What was the nature of it? But you co-wrote it, didn't you?
I did. I co-wrote it with my little brother, who was only 14, so he was clearly even more of a child prodigy.
And what was it? It was a particular...
It was called What to Eat When You Can't Eat Anything. So it was for people with food allergies. I was really sick when I was a kid and couldn't go to school. So my brother and I were homeschooled, which meant that we had all of this energy and time and drove my poor mum insane. So I think she was just like, write a cookbook. Go away and do something. Go write a cookbook.
And burn off all that energy.
Clearly we had to do something with it. It was amazing. It was a bestseller in the UK and Ireland and the US, but then I fell in love with sparkly things. So my path took a different turn.
You were homeschooled till you were what?
Till I was 15, I went to did junior social leaving cert through school.
Through school, but otherwise you're homeschooled.
Homeschooled the whole way.
What is that like? I mean, is it fun or do you miss school?
It's amazing. I think my parents weren't religious, so lots of homeschooling now happens because people don't agree with the system, or I was just really sick and couldn't go to school. And it was amazing because my mum is a brilliant woman who'd be like, okay, today we're learning physics, tomorrow we're learning French.
Yeah.
And it meant that it gave me this love of learning. And I've had so many careers. I'm 34, I've been a cookbook writer, I've been a fashion designer for Topshop, and now I'm a jeweller for Chupi. And
you think that came from
totally.
The variety and not the rote learning of school as we know it?
I think one of the things with school is you're told you're not going to be good enough, you can't do something, but someone has to be the fashion designer, someone has to be the astronaut, and my mum always instilled that in us. If we worked hard enough, we could be anything we wanted to be.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Thursday. Well, just before dawn last Saturday, thousands of people across the country took part in the Darkness into Light Walk to fundraise for Pieta House, the suicide prevention and counselling service. RTE Sports broadcaster Yvonne Quillen lost her younger brother Cormac to suicide almost 5 years ago. And as she told Miriam O'Callaghan, she was conscious of how fragile he was in the run-up to her wedding. And both she and her partner Brian discussed it.
He understood how I didn't want a big wedding. I didn't want a big hotel and, the pressure environment. We did something a lot more laid back and relaxed. But yet, unfortunately, what I feared came to pass. And, Cormac didn't deal with the day very well and kind of spiralled a little bit after that. And unfortunately passed away 6 weeks after the wedding. So, I have to live with that, because what I feared came to pass in a way. He didn't deal very well with that social situation, and I feel sometimes it was the trigger, but it could have been anything else as well.
And Yvonne recalled the day Cormac died.
The morning that Cormac died, he was up early, but that wouldn't be unusual. And, Mam said that she had heard him moving around, and I think she heard him leaving the house, and he was on his bike into town. And I think she might have rang him or he rang her, and I think they had a frank discussion. I don't really want to say too much, Mam knew. I think she could feel that this was not going to end well. And he was found later that day.
And were you at work when you heard?
Yeah, I was at work. It was Halloween night or whatever, and it was a mess because Brian was actually away working, and Mam and Dad obviously didn't want to ring me at work, so they rang him. And then he got in the car to try and find me, and I don't like thinking about it. It wasn't a nice way to find out. I wasn't at my desk, so he couldn't find me, and then he was speaking to his brother, and then it turned out that his brother broke the news to me inadvertently, and it was bad.
How did you deal with it? Did you deal with it by looking after others or not?
I certainly didn't leave. I didn't want to leave Kilkenny for a long time. And I didn't come back to work for 5 or 6 weeks. And it was mostly because I wanted to be at home with Mam and Dad, but mostly Mam. So I don't know how I dealt with it, to be honest with you. I didn't. I probably didn't. A few months later, I felt completely overwhelmed. I was back at work after a few months. And we'd gone through the winter, and, the winter is horrible for anybody. But when you're grieving, it's even worse. And at the time I was doing a shift on Morning Edition. It was a programme we had, and I was in very early in the morning. And because I knew Cormac would have struggled at that time in the morning, I then started to really hate and feel really uneasy and uptight at that kind of 6 a.m. driving into work. It's dark, there's nobody around. And I just remember one morning driving in the Stillorgan dual carriageway, and there was beautiful music on the radio, as there is at that time in the morning. And I just completely broke down, because it was that time in the day, and that's still the time of day I think about Cormac. And that's why The Darkness Into Light is so poignant, because so many people who are going through it or have gone through it or who are actually suffering, it's a nice thing to think that you can be surrounded by people at that time in the morning and people who understand what you're going through.
RTE's Yvonne Quillen heard on Sunday with Miriam. Well, it was a bumper week for beautiful music here on RT Radio 1. Fiddle player Seamus Maguire and harpist Florian Blanc were Sean O'Rourke's guests yesterday, live in Studio 7. And they played this recently discovered tune by Tarlac O'Carolan from about 300 years ago, Planxty No. 12. Thank you. just lovely. Seamus Maguire on fiddle and Florian Blanc on the harp, heard on the Today Show yesterday. It's over 3 weeks since the cervical check scandal first broke and the fallout continues. This week, the top civil servant at the Department of Health defended the decision not to inform any minister about the delays in telling women the results of the cervical screening audits. Jim Breslin was questioned by Fianna Fáil's health spokesman, Stephen Donnelly, when he appeared before the Doyle Health Committee.
The department was told by the HSE that cervical check was about to do something that could lead to a loss of confidence in the programme due to media coverage and the public reaction. And that is exactly what has just happened. Is that not the sort of warning that the department should escalate to a minister?
Within the whole gamut of issues that are being managed across the health service, it wasn't of sufficient scale and it was being dealt with in an appropriate fashion according to a good, open approach with women, that it didn't need to be escalated.
Meanwhile, in her search for answers, Vicky Phelan, the terminally ill woman whose High Court case revealed the scandal, appeared before the Public Accounts Committee on Wednesday, along with Stephen Teep, who lost his wife Irene to cervical cancer.
The big thing for me is the patient safety. I'm not interested in kind of revenge, you know, that's not what I'm here for. I do want to see accountability, and I would like to see a legacy that this will never happen again to any woman, man or child in this country, because there are, you know, this is not just a woman issue. This is, you know, affecting men and children who are without their mothers.
But this, it seems to be that the people in these senior positions that knew about all of these memos in 2016 are the same people that are in senior positions today that need to be questioned when it comes to these inquiries. And I don't understand how they can sit in these positions while inquiries are going on. We have dead women here. We have women who have been given terminal diagnoses, death sentences.
Stephen Teep and Vicky Phelan heard on the News at One. Well, the scandal was also discussed on the gathering yesterday by TD's Colin Brophy and Pather Tobin and by Baroness Nuala O'Loan and journalist Alison O'Connor.
If you look at the front page of the Irish Times, the figures for confidence in government have dropped quite substantially. Satisfied with government, 37%, down 7%. Dissatisfied, up 6% to 53%. And where women are concerned, it's even worse from the government point of view. 29% satisfied, 58% dissatisfied. There's political damage. Alison?
I mean, overall, Sean, I think that this scandal, the way it's been handled, the fallout, the different aspects of it, it's the chickens coming home to roost over decades of mismanagement, really, in our health services. For me, Vicky Phelan is an absolutely extraordinary woman. Her strength, particularly at this time in her life with what she's facing, and people like Stephen Teep also, and their bravery. But I'm really quite queasy, I have to say, at how these people being invited before Dáil committees, the PAC particularly. I mean, that's all the PAC is about, state funds being mismanaged, essentially. And that what you're looking at is kind of virtue signalling by politicians who are trying to jump on board.
But
this
is there
controversy.
Not very important and information coming out? I mean, even allowing
yeah,
for what
yeah,
you say,
there, yeah,
it may
there
be,
is,
it may
but
be
maybe
valid.
Not in the right, but maybe not in the, you know, in the right. I mean, the politicians collectively, they've all had their hands on the tiller of health at some stage in the last 20 years. And I'd put this to you, I'd say, like, Fine Gael are in government since 2011 and we still don't even know what their health policy is. And that sort of sums it up for me.
Sorry, Nuala, you wanted in there.
Yeah, I did want in because I think there are women now going for screening. I don't know to what extent they can rely on the testing that's going on the smears that are being done on them. And there's a whole tranche of women who have been had screening in the past and don't know yet whether they're in or out of this. This is a terrible situation for the women of Ireland. The cervical cancer is one of the most dangerous cancers. It kills so quickly, and once it gets a hold, it can't be cured. So I think that the accountability issue, allowing Gabriel Scally to get on with the work, is profoundly important. Allowing him to gather all the documents, getting the Department of the Health and HSE to gather all the documents together, that's obviously going to be a big job. Bring all those documents in, let him do the job, because there has to be accountability. We have to be sure that it won't happen again. And most of all, I think, for the women of Ireland, they need to be able to trust their doctors and their health service, that when they go in and they get an answer, if they're told they're all right, they really are all right.
on an entirely different topic, the royal wedding. Will you be watching Colin Brophy?
I will watch it on news highlights or whatever, okay. But it wouldn't be something I'd watch.
Newell, I dare say, I'm sorry about invitation.
That. Yeah, I haven't got an invitation. I'll be preparing for a seminar I'm doing in Rome for the Irish and British governments on the Good Friday Agreement. So that's what I'll be doing on Saturday, not watching television.
I have to sort out my sock drawer, unfortunately. It's in serious need of attention.
God, what a crowd of wet blankets. You know what? I've had a pretty crap week. I've had the flu, the missing communion shoes. I am looking forward to having a good old look at it and enjoying it and seeing what the dress is like and feeling joy for the happy cup.
Alison O'Connor, Baroness Newell O'Lone, Pather Tobin and Colin Brophy with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. Julia Kelly was a fledgling writer and a bit lost and unsure of herself when she met and fell in love with the painter Charlie Whisker in 2004. Initially, it was an idyllic partnership, despite the 20-year age gap between them. Charlie became her mentor. They had a daughter together. They led a glamorous lifestyle with lots of famous friends, among them Bono and Ali. And her memoir, Matchstick Man, is about that heady time. But it also describes the cruel reality of life after Charlie was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. Julia was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Tuesday.
I was just completely fascinated by him. I couldn't compare him to anyone I'd ever met before. I found him, just his turn of phrase, his stories, his the way he looked at life, everything about him I just found completely fascinating.
He's a painter and you were the struggling would-be writer at that stage. How helpful to you was he then with that?
I would say he's the reason I became a writer. It's so exceptionally helpful and probably in the end, possibly a bit too helpful. I think I relied on him too much and eventually I think you have to take flight on your own. But at the very beginning, I lent on him hugely. He taught me to write with using not just the visual, but using all my senses. You know, how does something smell? How do you know how the sound of it, feel of it, turn things upside down? He'd go through my work painstakingly, go through my work, and he'd take out all unnecessary words. One day he went upstairs and came down with some of his own work. And he said, this is how you do it. And I mean, given that he wasn't, you know, a writer himself, it was kind of slightly irritating. But and often he put a line through, he'd stop editing and there'd be a line through a whole page and it'd be PTO at the bottom and he would have rewritten it the way he felt it should be written. And he'd produce big lists of words, like often quite pretentious words, but big long lists of words for me to use in my work.
Theirs is a complex story with lots of trauma, financial problems and shed loads of heartache. Their relationship eventually fell apart and Charlie's illness became very difficult to manage. He's now cared for in a nursing home, but she and Ruby May, who's now 9, visit often.
The book opens with this description of it was around Christmas. And he literally kind of headed off, you know, he bolted, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine his illness was fairly advanced at that stage, although he wasn't in permanent care.
Yeah, he ran away quite a bit. I think that seems to be a common thing with Alzheimer's, is that there's this real restlessness. And he was very, very agitated initially and very scared by it all and angry and overwhelmed and at times suicidal.
And what about Ruby May? And she visits him?
She visits him I probably once a week. I have to keep the visits short. She's incredibly sweet with him. She, as he is with her, she holds his hand to kind of help him across the road. She puts on his shoes for him. She tries to keep everything calm and she talks to him in quite an adult way. But she's a little bit nervous of being left alone with him. You know, even if I go off to the bathroom or to talk to one of the staff, she prefers to come with me.
Would that be because of things that happened maybe that shouldn't have happened? Maybe he was just a little bit rough the way he treated her.
Yeah, I think she was a little bit scared. I mean, we've always had a much closer bond than Ruby May and her father. But she's she saw some very frightening incidents and they had some tricky times together.
I think there was one where he was trying to put her into a car seat. Was it upside down?
Yeah, she's a very logical child and she knew it was wrong and he was trying to force her. He turned the car seat somehow completely upside down and he was trying to force her into it and she was screaming and that those sorts of things happened quite a bit where, you know, it became acutely stressful, really.
And you described that stress and worry and the financial strain and the acute difficulty, I suppose, of constantly looking after somebody in the book. I mean, how has this experience affected you, would you say?
I feel like I'm kind of coming out the other end of it. I feel closer to Charlie than I've ever felt. I love him more than I've ever loved him, but it's not a romantic love. It hasn't been a romantic love for a long, long time. Charlie was always into, you know, aesthetics and beautiful home and a younger partner and, you know, his friends and status. And I mean, part of him was into that stuff, you know. And now he all of that is stripped away and he sees beauty. Like, I was going for a walk with him recently and he crouched down in Blackrock Park and there was a little bundle of daisies just blowing, a little cluster of daisies blowing in the wind, and he just knelt down and he said, look at those guys, look at them, aren't they perfect? Mm-hmm. And he just, and he loves things like I massage his head with E45 cream and things like that are just pure bliss to him. And whiskey and ice cream and Werther's originals. He gets to a family pack a day.
Julia Kelly, author of Matchstick Man, heard on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. The Nigerian novelist and inspirational feminist thinker Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie was in Dublin ahead of the International Literature Festival this weekend. Her books, Purple Hibiscus, Half a Yellow Sun and Americana, have been acclaimed all over the world, as has her TED talk, We Should All Be Feminists. Chimamanda was Sean Rock's guest on Arena and he asked her about her hopes for this generation of women.
Are we on the cusp of something? Are you optimistic that we're on the cusp of something? How do you feel?
I'm cautiously optimistic. And I think I would have to put the emphasis on the cautiously, because I know a lot. I know enough about the history of women and women's movements, and to know that it, sometimes when you think we're there or we're close to there, it turns out we're not. But what I have felt encouraged by is just, it just seems to me that it seems a bit more serious this time. I mean, and so that gives me hope. I think that women are not just telling their stories and being believed, but that consequences follow. And I think that's the difference. And I really hope that it's not a passing thing. I hope that it means that real changes will happen. But honestly, I don't know.
And she believes anger can be a force for change.
And I think we need to teach girls and women to not be so interested in likability. Right? Do your thing. Don't perform to be liked. Somebody will like you. There's so much about women holding themselves back because they know that they will be judged. So they hold back on their ambition, they hold back on their rage. You know, anger really isn't allowed women. Anger is read differently in female bodies and in male bodies.
And how essential is anger?
I think anger is an essential part of being human. That anger is a part of us, and it's not something that one should apologize about. And particularly, I love righteous rage. I think that rage has led to good change in the world.
The writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie heard on Thursday night's Arena. Well, we were tripping over Pulitzer Prize winners on the airwaves this week. Ron Susskind was on with Ryan Tuberty, and Ronan Farrow was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Tuesday. Ronan comes from Hollywood royalty. His mother is Mia Farrow and his estranged father, the filmmaker Woody Allen. But it was his investigative work for The New Yorker on the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse allegations which won him the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, a prize he shared with The New York Times. He's still only 30 and his new book, War and Peace, is a study of the decline of the once powerful American diplomatic corps and the effect that's having on world politics in places like Korea, Iran, Russia and China. But first he told a great story about his own early days as a staffer in the State Department under Hillary Clinton and Richard Holbrook, one of the giant figures of American diplomacy.
The way he recruited you, it was a far from normal or regular kind of a process, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Richard Holbrook was a madcap kind of character, larger than life, as you say, massive ego, and completely oblivious to the sensitivities of those around him a lot of the time. You know, I tell the story in War on Peace of him standing in a torrential downpour with an ex-girlfriend, waiting for a cab in New York City, and then when one finally arrived, him pecking her on the cheek and hopping into that cab himself and leaving her behind in the rain. And that was typical and one of the manifestations of that obliviousness and singular focus on his goals was everyone had a story about Richard Holbrooke continuing meetings into bathrooms. And Hillary Clinton told the story for all the years since of how he followed her into a ladies' room in Paris Pakistan. He was so enthusiastically briefing her on one occasion. And likewise, our job interview, which began at the State Department and ascended to the top of that building where we did a brief interview with Hillary Clinton and then left the building and went to his townhouse in Washington, D.C., included a trip upstairs during which he just hopped in the shower. And, you know, I was on the other side of a closed ajar door, I should say. This was not a Me Too moment, but it was a funny reflection of just how completely oblivious he could be to other people. He continued lobbing hardball questions about Taliban negotiations and American assistance to Afghanistan and Pakistan, over the hiss of shower water. And that's how I did the job interview.
I think listeners will well understand why, and we don't often use this kind of language. You describe him as a classic bully, the rare asshole who was worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was worth it. You know, my portrait of Richard Holbrooke and of a number of giant figures of diplomacy, every living Secretary of State of the United States goes on the record in this book.
Yeah.
All of them are complicated pictures of people with many strengths and sincere commitments to making the world a better place and also a lot of foibles. And Richard Holbrooke was both.
At the heart of his book, War on Peace, Ronan Farrow claims that the voices of diplomats, the negotiators and peacemakers have been pushed to the margins of the American foreign policy process, overtaken by military voices to the detriment of the world.
Well, it's fascinating. Since September 11th, 2001, there has been a real transformation in America's role in the world. More and more of the work that was once the domain of designated experts and diplomats and development specialists is now done out of the Pentagon and the CIA by soldiers, by spies. And this is not to malign the soldiers and the spies, who are also an important part of keeping the United States safe. But what Secretary of State after Secretary of State and expert after expert tell me in the pages of War on Peace is that the balance is way, way out of whack, that we have stripped the State Department of capacity so badly and for so long. And right now we are in the midst of such an unprecedented purging of the State Department that there are real fears that this side of American power is in a nosedive and that we are becoming more and more shackled to the only voices in the room being military voices who are, understandably much more focused on their tactical goals, you know, how to succeed on the battlefield in the short term.
Ronan Farrow heard on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. The former Munster and Ireland rugby player Frankie Sheehan was Richard Curran's guest on The Business. He's the founder of Dublin's Pendulum Summit, which focuses on self-improvement and empowerment, and will be branching out to New York City in the autumn. But things haven't always been rosy in the garden for Frankie. The property crash hit him particularly hard. In fact, he just came out of bankruptcy earlier this year. And Richard wondered how he'd kept going through the bad times.
Richard, it's no different to, I suppose, any adversity that people have in life and in business. And you have a choice. What do you do? Do you jump in? I'm the victim here. Poor me. Look at me. You know, or do you just take responsibility? And I've taken 100% responsibility for my investments and for what has happened. It is my fault, and I'm going to blame myself 100%. It's nobody else's fault. I don't harbour any bitterness or any resentment to anybody else. And that's it. You know, you just get on with it and deal with it. And you know, no point in looking in the rearview mirrors. You need to drive things on. And I think everybody has that choice when adversity happens. I'm probably lucky going through the sporting career and thankful, you know, I suppose when you look back at the successes I've had on the rugby field, I've probably had more, lost some. I remember one year lost three finals in a row, lost Cork Con, we lost to Leinster and we lost to Leicester.
And that hurts in its own way.
It hurts, and it really does hurt, you know. And I remember after one of the particular games, I was fairly rattled actually. And Declan Kidney pulled me aside and said, "Frankie, you know, you gotta start dealing with this." And I said, "I can't. I'm just gutted, you know." And He sent me to see Declan O'Hearn, the sports psychologist who's works out of UL, and spoke to Declan, and not long into the conversation, Declan said, Frankie, you're going to have to use the 10-yard rule. And I said, what's the 10-yard rule, Declan? And he said, well, Tiger Woods, he said, when he hits a bad shot, he doesn't get over it immediately. He allows himself the time to give out for the time. He puts the club back into the bag and he walks 10 yards. He can bitch, he can moan, he can do whatever he needs to do. But once he walks beyond that 10-yard line, bang, he moves on then immediately. And I think that's, you know, one of the things definitely that would have helped me from the rugby field.
Frankie Sheehan heard on The Business with Richard Curran. But I leave you now with a song from Scullion. Sonny Condell, Philip King and Robbie Overson. And they played live for Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. Gurumaha gavaswar goluther, nive ein cloran tachtan johogan the war on refren, ach gudi an tachtan an yishin, gudi eishab slán.
Taller, I can't get my head around it.